I'm sorry, you're making the assumption that I remember what happened 30 seconds ago.
The VGRT Gaming Podcast, episode 349, recorded on April 30th, 2014. And welcome to the 349th edition of the TD Gaming Podcast and 182nd episode of Video Game Roundtable. I am Jonah Falcon.
And I am Jordan Lund.
The VGRT Gaming Podcast focuses on game news from around the industry. So there's no gaming flashback and no gaming history, but we do have some rear mails and some very intriguing news. But before we do that, what have you been playing, Jordan?
I have been playing Replace a Dead Car is what I've been playing. My wife's car died, and so we found ourselves carless while hers was being repaired because my car had died previously the year before, and I just had never been able to replace it because of a broken foot. So we finally, healthy, and went out and bought a new car and got my wife's car fixed, so we can actually stop to think about games again.
Oh, you know, I thought you might get a loaner from the company that's repairing your car.
Well, her repair took a couple of days. So, it wasn't loaner ish type material. So, yeah.
You know what I heard about Volkswagen bugs or beetles? They're massive inside. It's almost like a TARDIS, you know, where it's a lot bigger than the inside. That doesn't surprise me.
My PT Cruiser that died was very much the same way, much bigger on the inside than it appeared from the outside.
So, have you been playing anything?
No, I haven't been playing anything. I've been playing, figure out how to get around town, how to get my wife to work and all of that stuff. We haven't been able – I didn't get home until like 10 o'clock last night.
Carpooling.
Yeah, I rented a car for a couple of days to get us over the hump. And, it's been a rough couple of days, but it's all behind us now.
So I've started playing Out of the Park Baseball 15, which for some of you know, it's a baseball simulation. The thing is, I've been reviewing the thing since it first came out, since it was Out of the Park 1 back in 99. And, there are certain things that I wish they would improve, like being able to have real-time online instead of just, upload, download. You know, it would be nice to have real-time interaction. I've also been playing South Park The Stick of Truth, but I stopped playing it, not because I don't like it, but it just seems like, I want to give it a break for a moment. And I started playing Batman Arkham Asylum again, just to run through the story. So, and one of the interesting things is that a lot of things are not, seem peculiar to me. Like, throwing your Batarang is not part of a combo. If you do that, it ends the combo, which is shocking to me, because I'm always used to having that as part of the combo.
Yeah, wasn't that part of the combo in the other games?
In the other two games, yeah. I'm wondering if I have to research, but I checked. It's not something I research on the bat thing, so.
In the original games, wasn't a skill you had to add?
Yes,
to
I thought so, but it didn't. Yeah. It didn't. It's not adding,
Interesting.
Using devices doesn't add. Also, when you use your thing to open up electronic locks, it destroys the lock. It doesn't find the password. It just overloads it.
Just trashes the lock.
Gotcha. Yeah. I'm still enjoying the story. The one thing I like is it's a lot easier to get the Riddler stuff, in the two sequels, they have you jumping through so many hoops. It was just boring. I just want to be able to do, be intelligent, find things, and then, not have to, you have to run through this thing and hit that, and, I just love the way the Riddler gets caught by the police when you capture all of his things, and because what happens is you've been stalling him and tracking him on your little device.
I see.
Yeah. So I also haven't played Titanfall lately, but that's because I haven't had the time to. And when I do, I will be broadcasting it. I mean, I could broadcast anything. I could broadcast Dead Rising 3 or NBA 2K14, but it seems like everybody's broadcasting their Titanfall matches.
That's been the problem on the PlayStation 4 is people start broadcasting their living rooms, and all sorts of interesting things happen in PlayStation 4 owners' living room.
Well, that's not one of the news items, so because I know that the 1.70 update has hit, and that's not one of the news items, but you might as well tell us what's going on with that.
Well, the 1.70 update, I believe actually launches today. I haven't had a chance to download it yet. It launched today. Yeah, it launched by the time of the podcast.
Oh, it launched earlier today.
Yeah, I haven't had a chance to actually download it and try it out yet.
Oh.
I think the biggest feature that everybody has everybody talking about, which is a strange thing for everybody to be talking about, is the ability to dim the light bar on the controller. That was one of the things that people have been demanding since before the console even launched.
I don't get it.
It drains the battery fast.
On. Now I can. Why even bother having that if it's going to be draining your battery? Seriously. I mean,
the reason they added it is that if you have the PlayStation camera, it tracks the controller like a Move controller. And so that's the only point to having the light bar on the controller, as near as I can tell. Well, and there are other kind of environmental things, like when your health is low, it'll change color and stuff like that.
What was that entire thing that you were talking about just before that,
Since launch, you could broadcast your games,
right?
And that's something that there's a live on PlayStation channel, and you just go there and you can watch people playing games.
Yeah, we already had that little controversy earlier with that when Sony started or Twitch. Was it Sony or Twitch that started banning people channels because they're?
I believe it was Twitch. Yeah, started banning people because of various unsavory content on their video cameras.
What did they expect?
I don't know what they expected. I don't know that they expected people.
There's a 13-year-old to play consoles,
smoking dope and having sex on camera. So
no, the funniest one was this guy getting a girl drunk that he apparently knew, and doing things to her while she was sleeping.
That was
unconscious.
Cool. Or pretending to be unconscious, we don't know. The other thing that was funny with the broadcasting was that if you have the camera, you can hold up anything and broadcast it. So people were holding up their PlayStation Vitas and broadcasting Vita games.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Right now Titanfall is just draining Twitch. I mean, it's like a couple billion Titanfall matches, mm-hmm. Recorded, and usually it's YouTube that is the one that has all those matches, right?
Right.
I just wish I could get a clearer. I mean, maybe next time it'll be clearer, because when I first did it, it was pixelated because the action was going too fast. And the thing is, it has to be me because I've seen other people's Twitch broadcasts of their Titanfall things, and they don't have the same issue. And I'm talking about the Xbox One version. I'm pretty sure people who stream their PC version have a really fast connection,
Yeah. So what do you think?
I don't know. I can try other games. I mean, NBA 2K14 as well. We're going to move on to game news. Take it away, Jordan.
Sure. I wasn't expecting to go first, but Nintendo skipping E3 media briefing again. This comes to us from Games Industry Biz. Nintendo has laid out its E3 2014 plans, and it appears the Wii U maker will stay the course it first charted in 2013. For the second year in a row, Nintendo will skip the traditional live media briefing in favor of an online unveiling for its new games and announcements. The lack of a media briefing isn't the only part of Nintendo's E3 2013 strategy to return this year. The company is also reprising a joint marketing effort with Best Buy that will see the upcoming Wii U Super Smash Bros. Game playable at a variety of the big box retailers' locations across the U.S. during the show. That isn't to say the company won't have a significant presence around Los Angeles Convention Center. Nintendo may not be using the neighborhood Nokia Theater for a media briefing, but the company has still booked the venue to host a Super Smash Bros. Invitational tournament with 16 players competing in front of thousands of Nintendo fans in L.A. and many more online. The replacement for the traditional media briefing, dubbed the Nintendo Digital Event, has been set for June 10th at 9 a.m. Pacific time.
Yeah. Last year, when they did that digital event, if I remember, you said it was a big snooze.
Yeah. It was not very exciting.
Yeah. I mean, and I'm sorry. I know it has a lot of fans, but to me, Super Smash Brothers is basically mashing the A button over and over and over and over and over again.
Super Smash Brothers, and people hate me for saying this, but I'm going to say it anyway. Super Smash Brothers is baby's first fighting game.
Well, that's what Yahtzee said, and he got pilloried so much so that he had to do a special article about the responses that he got, revealing all his letters. So, let's talk about Nintendo as a whole. And too bad Paul isn't here, or else, you know, we could discuss this further.
Paul is the Nintendo fan.
Well, yeah, but he's not a sycophantic Nintendo fan.
No, absolutely not.
You know, I mean,
he has not fully drunk the Kool-Aid. He's maybe drunk a third to a fifth of the Kool-Aid.
When Paul's complaining that he's not really all that into Zelda, there's something wrong.
Yeah.
So Nintendo's status right now, what do you think?
Well, their status is abysmal, right? The two consoles came out and outsold the lifetime Wii U sales in a matter of months. So, you know, it's not good for Nintendo right now.
Well, here's the thing. How much stress do you think they're putting on their handhelds then?
Well, you know, I don't know in terms of stress. I mean,
how much stress?
The 3DS sales have been slipping as well. So, you know, it's not like their handhelds get any more advertisement than the Wii U does.
That's just because of of saturation, not because of popularity.
Right.
I mean,
look at it like this. They had a new handheld come out, the 2DS, right? Mm-hmm. How much are they pushing the 2DS? It doesn't seem to me like they're pushing it at all.
Maybe they're getting the 3DS or the 2DS, depending on which they have. You know, I'll probably regret it, but you know, I think the prices are going down on those, so I'll be keeping an eye out for it. One weird thing is the next item, and you could take this one too, Jordan, because it's directly related. This actually is right now fresh off the hot off the hot off the presses.
Hot off the presses in a digital era with no heat and no presses. Nintendo includes, then removes, mention of new Nintendo system on E3 website. This comes to us from Nintendo Everything. Earlier today, Nintendo launched its official website for E3 2014. You can find it here. Just until a short while ago, the page included an interesting mention of a new Nintendo system in its source code. The strange thing, it's gone now.
You know, now that I think about it, it might be just be a 3DS with another color, you know, red
and blue. It's not. I looked at the source code and what it is it's keywords for an SEO ranking. And what they did is they copied and pasted it from the last E3. When the Wii U actually was the new Nintendo system. And so what they did is they had those keywords out there. So anybody searching for a new Nintendo system thinking of the Wii U would end up on their landing page.
That was 2012, not 2013.
That was 2012. So, you know, the phrase is out there in reference to the existing Wii U. It has nothing to do with a new console. It's all about SEO search keywords, and that's all it is.
You know what? I'm willing to bet still that, you know what Nintendo's answer is for flagging console sales? Just release it in new colors.
Yes, exactly.
You know, red, blue, you know.
That works in Japan. That works in Japan like gangbusters. They love their new console colors.
Yeah. I mean, well, here it appeals to me since I don't have a 3DS. So I'd be getting a new 3DS. You know what I'd like to see if they release it in something like what Microsoft did with the controllers in chrome and gold metal and all that stuff, you know, so it looks, you know, so it's nice and shiny.
Brass.
Yeah, something like that.
A brass one, that would be neat.
Okay, we're going to move on to the next item, and I know this one tickles.
This is my favorite article of the entire show, and you get to read this one. This is awesome.
E.T. cartridges unearthed in New Mexico, and this comes to us from Games Industry Biz. A documentary team accompanied by senior figures at Microsoft have unearthed copies of Atari's disastrous E.T. game in the New Mexico desert. By the way, a couple of months ago, we actually had the story about the documentary team going out there, and this was like last year. So this has come to fruition. The idea that Atari dumped huge quantities of its financially disastrous 1982 game is one of the industry's most enduring legends. And on Saturday, that legend was finally proved as true when copies of E.T. the Extraterrestrial were unearthed for a documentary backed by Microsoft Fuel Entertainment and Lightbox Entertainment. Microsoft's Larry, Major Nelson Herb, and social media director Jeff Rubenstein were present for the crucial moment and tweeted pictures of their success to a waiting world. However, while these photos prove that the rumors are true, it isn't clear just how many cartridges were found. Estimates of the number discarded by Atari have ranged from the hundreds of thousands right into the millions, but the pictures released from the dig site show only a handful of copies. I will add that it wasn't just E.T. cartridges they pulled up. There was one Centipede 2600 cartridge that I saw, which made me weep, because that was not a bad game.
And there were also consoles as well. Now, one of the estimates that I saw in all the various articles talking about this mentioned 14 truckloads of stuff. was found. So they put out one table to have a handful of samplings of what they found, but apparently there was something on the order of 14 truckloads. So I expect at some point this will be packaged and cleaned and laminate sealed and sold as memorabilia.
One of the cartridges they were holding looked very, very much intact.
Oh yeah, absolutely. A lot of the cartridges looked very intact.
I mean,
which is interesting because one of the rumors was that they sealed it all in concrete, which obviously, that's kind of
what's the word I'm looking for? Inefficient.
Yeah.
You know,
it's not radioactive. Well, it is ET. Never mind.
It's not that kind of radioactive waste. Yeah. But you know, the documentary and what I hope this documentary does is it discusses the entire crash, you know, the 1983 video game crash. Because just having a documentary about the E.T. game would be kind of dull, especially since there's not much you could get out of it. Gameplay, and then it was tossed away, you know, and have shots in the movie. No. You have to put the entire thing in perspective.
Now, and I would like to add my little piece to that particular conspiracy theory, because my argument is that the 1983 video game crash did not actually happen.
Well, let me put it this way. The Commodore 64 just buried the consoles. And, you know, what happened was that people were dropping left and right. It was a crash.
Well, the hardware companies, Atari and Coleco, went down. Commodore went up. And all of the game producers, all of the games worth playing, moved to the Commodore 64 platform. And that's what, you know, where gaming went. It wasn't that gaming died or that there was a crash. It moved from the television-based consoles to the television-based Commodore 64.
Well, one of the reasons for the crash was inflation, you know.
Oh, absolutely. The early years under Reagan were terrible inflationary period. Absolutely correct.
Yeah, but I never thought that E.T. was the worst video game ever. I mean, it was playable, and, you know, while it was a bit simple, you know, it wasn't that bad. I mean,
there were worse 2600 games.
I thought the Raiders of the Lost Ark game was worse because it was incomprehensible to me. The puzzles that they had were just weird. You know,
I think that was a lot of the complaint about E.T. as well, is that it wasn't immediately clear what the player was supposed to do.
Yeah. I mean, the other thing is that, you know, one of the problems is something that we have today. And that is that in 1982, there was a glut of games. I mean, the market was super saturated. I mean, it was well oversaturated.
The market was super saturated, and Atari actually made more ET cartridges than there were 2600s at the time. So
it wasn't even just that. It was that just games, you know, it was just too much, you know, and we saw what happened to Guitar Hero, you know.
Right.
What was really the most tragic part of the video game crash is that Imagic went down, and I loved Imagic games, all of them.
I remember Imagic, the name. I can't remember a game that they did.
Oh, come on. Are you kidding me?
I'm sure I played them.
Atlantis, remember that?
Atlantis and Demons.
Demon Attack.
Demon Attack. Yeah.
Microsurgeon, good stuff. Remember that one? Yeah. That was a weird one.
Yeah. All very good stuff.
Oh, and the first Imagic game I bought, and I really loved it, and this will be a little bit of parallel to you with the Xbox Live Arcade, Trick Shot.
I did not. I had the StarPath adapter for the 2600 that allowed you to hook up a tape drive.
Oh, and Riddle of the Sphinx, too.
And you could play the tape games, yeah.
And Riddle of the Sphinx. And the thing about Imagic was it really set itself apart because the cartridges, for one thing, were tapered at the end, and they looked like the Houston Astros uniform, you know, just this rainbow color and shiny on the top.
They had the rainbow logo, and they had the silver foil labels.
Yeah, and also it was tapered at one end. It was just really weird. But I don't know of any game on Magic that was bad. I think
there was not a bad game. No, absolutely.
But here's the thing: they
what was the other one? Phoenix. Phoenix was the other one, wasn't it?
No, there was Riddle of the Sphinx. Or you think of that? Laser Gates, I remember. Dragonfire.
The Dragonfire was another good one.
Yeah, but I remember Atlantis because that was sort of like reverse. You were on the top and you had to you were on the bottom. Damn, I'm trying to remember what it looks like. Oh, that's right. You're on the bottom. It was sort of like their version of Missile Command. That's right. they released it on a lot of stuff, but you know, even though they did multi-platform, the only thing I can think of them doing was Atari 2600.
I was thinking Cosmic Ark.
Oh, yeah, I remember that. Oh, yeah, the one when you're rescuing people, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the spaceship above there. Yeah, I played that as well. I mean, like I said, and their games are always, you know, they loved making shades of the same color, so it had that 3D look to it. Microsurgeon was bizarre, though. Do you remember that?
I don't remember Microsurgeon.
That's the one in which you actually went inside the body.
Oh, yeah.
Remember?
I remember that one now. Yeah.
Yeah, so I'm going to have to do a gaming history of Magic sometime.
It would be interesting to do a gaming history of iMagic or other of the big companies that really had multiple hits back to back. Cinemaware was another one that there was not a bad Cinemaware game.
Well, I mean, the thing about Cinemaware was that they were all visuals. You know, the gameplay could be a little bit. The first game that they made was that Robin Hood game. I forgot the name of it.
Defender of the Crown.
Yeah. And it was, you know, one thing is I didn't realize it was a territory control game. And now I recognize it as such.
One of the few strategy games that I actually liked.
Yeah, but you also had those action moments when you had to fight as Robin.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, and you had to use the Bastille to tear down the castle walls and stuff.
And
yes.
Then you got to kiss a top heavy princess behind just your shadow.
Yep.
Very top heavy. In fact, I'm surprised the girl could stand. Anyways, we're going to move on to the next item. I believe this is me. This is you, actually.
Yep. Sony Online Entertainment rolls out All Access program. This comes to us from GameZone. As expected, Sony Online has rolled out the all-new All Access membership plan, replacing the older $20 pass. Under the new plan, users pay $15 per month and receive top-tier level membership on all eligible SOE games, including EverQuest, EverQuest 2, DC Universe Online PC, PlanetSide 2 PC, Vanguard, Saga of Heroes, and the upcoming EverQuest Next Landmark and H1Z1. Extra savings options can be had for 3, 6, and 12-month subscription plans. SOE is also working to finalize membership benefits to Dragon's Profit. In addition to top-tier membership, other perks for the all-access plan include 500 station cash for use in game marketplaces every month, a 10% discount on marketplace purchases, and access to exclusive promotions and offers throughout the year.
I think this is brilliant. I think, you know, even if you're never going to play EverQuest or EverQuest 2, right? I mean, a lot of people play PlanetSide 2, and they might say, you know, I'd like to play, you know, I could do DC Universe 2. You know, I mean, they're all free to play.
If you're ponying into an MMO, you might as well pony into all of them for one fee, and getting the extra $500, 500 station cash per month kind of takes the sting out of it, too, if that's the sort of thing you would be buying anyway.
Well, the thing is, you know, everything is free to play now. All these games are free to play. But when you decide I will do the subscription, you get a lot of bonuses.
Right.
So this actually makes it even easier for you to do the $15 per month, which was, you know, what World of Warcraft charges. You know, and EverQuest Next looks really good. You know, H1Z1 is the new PS4 MMO. I don't know if you've heard of it yet.
I seem to remember hearing something about it, but I haven't seen anything on it.
But, you know, I mean, I haven't played DC Universe Online. I know some people like it, and I'm not a huge, huge fan of PlanetSide 2, but I am looking forward to EverQuest Next because it looks really, really good. And, you know, if you say do this, you know, you get, okay, I get EverQuest Next, and I get PlanetSide 2 and all the extra stuff, and DC Universe Online, you know, this is a brilliant way to get people to go subscription in a free-to-play market.
I did play DC Universe Online simply because it is free to play and there was a PlayStation 4 version on launch, and I wanted to see what it was like because, hey, you know, it's DC, but it's free to play. And it was all right. You know, I can't say that it really attracted my attention. It's not something that I camped in front of. I never played City of Heroes, I went through the first boss fight and got out into the city and then found that it was a whole bunch of fetch quests and went, no.
City of Heroes was more beat up quests, you know. But I'm going to say, you know, City of Heroes, playing City of Heroes for the first time was an experience because the character creation just made you faint. And the thing is that on their own, players started holding these costume contests. You would go to the main area of, you know, where everybody starts. and people would line up with their costumes and they would be judged. It was great. You know, whenever an MMO is able to inspire, you know, dynamic things like that without any prompting from the developers, you know you have something.
Right. Absolutely correct.
You know, we're going to move on to the next item. Now, this isn't exactly video game related, although it is a little bit because there's going to be games based on it. But
oh, there will be games based on it. Yes.
But we finally have this Star Wars Episode 7 cast announced. And this comes to us from StarWars.com. The Star Wars team is thrilled to announce the cast of Star Wars Episode 7. The actors include John Boyega, Daisy Ridley, Adam Driver, Oscar Isaac, Andy Serkis. Now, for those of you who don't know who Andy Serkis is, he was Gollum, and he was also Sonny from iRobot. You know, he does a lot of motion capture stuff.
He was King Kong in King Kong. Yeah.
Domhnall Gleeson and Max von Sydow. That's the most exciting to me, by the way.
I thought it was fantastic having Max von Sydow in a Star Wars flick.
Yeah.
The rest of these guys, I have to be frank, I have not heard of them. But who heard of Mark Hamill in 1977 either? You know, that's,
well, of course,
that's fine.
You know, to continue, you also have Harrison Ford, Carrie Fisher, Mark Hamill, Anthony Daniels, Peter Mayhew, and Kenny Baker. In other words, Solo, Leia, Luke, C-3PO, Chewbacca, and Kenny Baker is, of course, R2-D2.
Well, in the same kind of smaller roles as were played by Sir Alec Guinness and Peter Cushing in the original.
Sir Alec Guinness got nominated for Best Supporting Actor.
I did not know that.
Yes. Well, keep in mind, in 77, if you had a major big-budget film, you always had to have at least one – it would always garner one supporting actor just as a thank you for making billions of money. Director J.J. Abrams says, "We are so excited to finally share the cast of Star Wars Episode 7. It is both thrilling and surreal to watch the beloved original cast and these brilliant new performers come – well, Max von Sydow is not a new performer – to bring this world to life once again. We should start shooting in a couple of weeks, and everyone is doing their best to make the fans proud." Star Wars Episode 7 is being directed by J.J. Abrams from a – oh – is being directed by J.J. Abrams from a screenplay by none other than Lawrence Kasdan and J.J. Abrams. Now, for those of you who don't know, Lawrence Kasdan, who did stuff like The Accidental Tourist and The Big Chill and, you know, and Grand Canyon, he was the one who wrote the script for The Empire Strikes Back.
That is correct, yes.
Now, Kathleen Kennedy, who is normally associated with Steven Spielberg, J.J. Abrams and Brian Burke are producing, and John Williams returns as the composer. It shouldn't be that hard for him to do.
I would think he could probably compose Star Wars music in his sleep.
Yeah. The movie opens worldwide on December 18th, 2015. So,
Christmas
I mean...
Christmas next year?
I mean, the two... now, here's the thing is that J.J. Abrams was not the right pick for Star Trek. He is the right pick for Star Wars.
I didn't mind the two Star Trek movies. I thought they were fine.
Well, come on.
I think the DVD release of the second one was just a nightmare. But the entire movie was a nightmare. The two things that excite me, of course, Max von Sydow, who is a phenomenal actor.
He was also in Skyrim, you know.
Yeah, he did a voice in Skyrim. He plays classic villains. He was Ming the Merciless in the original Flash Gordon film back in the early 80s.
Too. I mean, look at from Pale the Conqueror.
And he does play heroes as well. In fact, my favorite role of
him. Oh, the Seventh Seal, for one thing. I mean, he was a hero in that.
my favorite film of his is What Dreams May Come. Where he plays this kind of ethereal guide in the afterlife for Robin Williams' character.
By the way, that his casting was sort of like a nod to the Seventh Seal.
Oh, okay.
You know, if you watch The Seventh Seal and then you watch What Dreams May Come, you'll notice certain similarities. And Max von Sydow, it wasn't a stunt casting because he's – you know, the funny thing is he's always seemed like he was 50 years old.
Yeah, I know.
He seemed like he was 60 when he did Flash Gordon, and that was back in 1980. I'm shocked he's still alive.
I know, and it's going to be phenomenal seeing him in a Star Wars film. And it's
Max
interesting.
Von Sydow's a good guy. We also forgot the obvious one, which is The Exorcist.
Oh, yes. Bring me an old priest and a young priest. So the thing about that is that he brings a certain gravitas to the role, and it's
even
interesting.
Even when he's camping it up like he did in Flash Gordon, I mean, he is practically giggling, saying every line. You know.
Yes. The thing that I find interesting is that, you know, people complained about the Harry Potter movies being basically we're going to get every actor in England, right, to be in the Harry Potter movies.
No, Star Wars, they just get every villain.
The same thing, right? You had Peter Cushing in the original, right?
Well, no, here's the thing is that they cast the main actors from Hollywood. However, they were shooting in England. So all the background and all the minor actors and all that stuff, except for Sir Alec Guinness, were based in England, which is why all the Empire are British, you know, which plays into the idea that the Brits are evil, you know. The thing that excites me the most
it's a very Lyndon LaRouche kind of mindset, yes. But even in the prequels, right? You got I'm blanking on his name, playing Count Dooku.
Christopher Lee. But the thing is that at that point, George Lucas was recycling everything, so you know
it was recycling everything. But you know, having an actor at that level, and I guess Max von Sydow is the only actor still alive who has not been in a Star Wars movie.
Oh well,
what's his
face is coming back to play Magneto, you know.
That's true. Ian McKellen. Ian McKellen hasn't been in a Star Wars movie yet. Maybe he'll be in Episode 8 or 9. We'll see.
Here's the thing: is that for one thing, it's Lawrence Kasdan. Now, I think part of it is because they said, "Well, who wrote the most popular Star Wars film, The Empire Strikes Back?" Oh, it was Lawrence Kasdan. But regardless, you know, he's a great writer to have, albeit you know he's pretty much of a yuppie. But you know, and J.J. Abrams knows how to. He knows action, right? But even more importantly, he knows how to have characters that you care about. So it's not like you have Michael Bay directing, right?
Well, the other thing that I found funny about all of this is that I don't know if you can say Lucasfilm anymore because Lucasfilm doesn't really exist. But Disney came out and they basically said that all of the expanded universe stuff is done. Forget it. It never happened. And after 7, 8, and 9 come out, there will be a new set of novels that will be essentially the new expanded universe post 7, 8, and 9.
Well, you know, the problem with Star Wars and its expanded universe is that Star Trek had a ton of episodes and animated episodes and all this stuff where they could build a universe from. Yeah, Star Wars, for the most part, had three movies.
Star Wars
That's
had
it.
Three, and you know there were associated little animated programs and stuff like that, but the rest of it all was in the novels and the comic books.
You know, I would suggest reading Splinter of the Mind's Eye, which is done by Alan Dean Foster. Mm-hmm. And the thing is that was written in case they couldn't get Harrison Ford back.
Right. I still have. Yeah. It was.
I saw it too.
It was written as a potential sequel to Star Wars. It didn't actually take off.
It included a deepening of the romance between Luke and Leia. Mm-hmm. It had Luke fighting Darth Vader, I think, in a place that was like Dagobah, actually.
It was very much like Dagobah, yeah. Exactly, yeah. And, I still have a first edition of that.
So do I. And yeah. I don't know if it's worth anything. I just found it funny because it's sort of like an alternate universe, you know?
It is, yeah. It's really considered to be the first expanded universe book. And, it was interesting.
But like I said, I'm intrigued by J.J. Abrams and Lawrence Kasdan working together, although Abrams is also with the screenplay as well.
Kasdan's
screenplay and tweaked it a bit.
Well, I would wonder too. You know, I haven't kept up with Lawrence Kasdan. What has he done recently? Has he done anything, say, in the last 10 or 15 years?
I can quickly find out.
We'd have to look up on the IMDb.
Because I know he's been active. I mean, the last thing I remember him doing was Grand Canyon, which was back in '99. I mean, writer. Where's the writer stuff? Oh, well, let's see. Grand Canyon, The Bodyguard, Wyatt Earp, Shadows of the Empire, which is a video game story, Mumford, Dreamcatcher. Oh, that was terrible, Green Dreamcatcher. And after that, he had a long hiatus from 2003 to 2012, Darling Companion, and now Star Wars Episode 7. So he hasn't done much since Dreamcatcher.
Gotcha.
And Dreamcatcher was just awful. I did not know he worked on Raiders of the Lost Ark, by the way.
I see the movie poster under his IMDb page. Yeah,
I didn't know he worked on Raiders of the Lost Ark. So, I mean, like I said, you know, you also have Kathleen Kennedy working on it, who was Steven Spielberg's what's it called, usual producer. So that, you know, it interests me. It seems like I will predict some things. I predict it's going to be very fast paced and very actiony, You know, it's not gonna be happy talking heads all over the place.
He did Silverado. Silverado was good. A very good movie.
Yeah, my favorite novel was The Accidental Tourist. He changed it in ways I didn't like, but it was still, you know, very good. But the thing is that, you know, so we're going to have a lot of action, but a lot of character interaction that doesn't feel like two puppets talking to each other.
Be right back. I'm going to go watch Silverado.
Don't you dare. We're going to move on to the next item. Go ahead, Jordan.
Skype group calls now. Let me try that again. Skype group calls now free on Xbox One and PC. This comes to us from Shack News. Microsoft has lifted the fee to use group video calling on its Skype service. The change means you can now host a chat across PC, Mac, and Xbox One without paying the previous $4.99 per month charge. GameSpot reports that the group calls allow up to 10 people at once, and Microsoft plans to support more platforms in the future, including iPad. The premium Skype service page has been altered to reflect the change as well.
I don't understand why you had to pay for that in the first place.
You shouldn't have had to pay for it, and certainly not since it only, on the Xbox at least, it only works if you have gold anyway.
Yeah. I mean, you know, and it's kind of neat because, you know, you can soon on your iPad as well, but, you know, you won't have to be attached to your Xbox One. You know, you'll have someone calling you on Skype and say, hey, listen, come to Xbox One. We're about to do a match, you know, and all that stuff.
Right.
I mean, it's minor news, but it's actually good news because, you know, one of the problems that Microsoft has had with the Xbox One, which they had perfected with the Xbox 360, is just, you know, the community and group play. I mean, it took them a long while just to have, and I don't even know if they have it yet, in which, you know, you're informed when a friend logs on.
Right.
But we will not be recording podcasts on the Xbox One, just so you know.
Well, you don't have the ability to record on it.
Oh,
so
I could record.
It would make it difficult.
I mean, I would just have it on my PC as well. Remember, it's now free. Okay.
You just dial the PC in. Yeah, that's true.
There's a group video calling. I wonder if group audio calling was free.
I don't know.
Well, you know, Microsoft owns Skype, so.
Right, that's true.
Well, I heard a rumor that Microsoft is getting ready to buy another. No, they bought Nokia. I thought they had already bought Nokia, but they bought Nokia outright.
They bought Nokia's patents originally, and then they bought Nokia as a whole. Yeah. Or it wasn't. I think it was a division of Nokia is what it was.
Well, now they own Nokia's lock, stock, and barrel, yeah. Which means we should see a lot of Windows Nokia phones. Actually, there were plenty of Windows Nokia phones.
All of the best Windows 8 phones were from Nokia.
Well, HTC.
Yeah.
HTC was pretty good. We can move on to the next item. Analyst, PC gaming now brings in more money than console gaming. And this comes to us from Ars Technica. Already I see Jordan putting his hand to his face in embarrassment, you know, doing a little face palm there. Anyone who's been playing games on PC for a while has lately gotten used to regular overblown pronouncements that computer gaming is on the verge of dying in the face of cheaper, easy-to-use console competition. Gamers rebuffing those changes should take heart from recent statements from DFC Intelligence analyst David Cole that PC gaming is far from dying. It's actually outperforming the console sector overall these days. And we must stress overall there. In statements reported by UK tech site CPR, Cole said that PC games are bringing in more revenue than console games on a global basis, although he added that the recent launch of new consoles, game consoles, could change things in the near future. Among core gamers, there is a heavy overlap with most console gamers also playing on PC. The big difference is that consoles are now the luxury item and PCs are the necessity. Just a few years ago, the reverse was true. This means PCs have a broader audience. We sampled public data to estimate sales and gameplay info for every Steam game. The growth in PC spending is being driven heavily by explosive growth in MOBAs like League of Legends and Dota 2. Outside of that, the PC market is supported by a nice mix of MMO strategy and first-person shooter games. The PC gaming market is also dominated by older titles. Cole says there wasn't a single title released in 2013 that made the top 20 list of most games played that year. Though 2014 releases like DayZ, Rust, and Hearthstone have managed to crack the popularity lists. PC gaming revenue growth has been especially strong in Europe and among free-to-play titles. So, Jordan, I'm going to let you take first crack at this.
So, first off, this article is a stunning example of weasel words. If the ET article is my favorite article of the bunch, this one is clearly my least favorite of the bunch.
You know, the funny thing is that a little background here with DTC. They predicted the numbers for PC gaming 3 years ago, and they have been right on the money in terms of, and what that means is they're going to be getting a lot more service because because they no longer publish the results. We don't do much anymore.
Right, right.
NPD, so, right? The NPD.
The NPD.
So what happens is that, you know, and the NPD was never high on doing video, PC game sales either, you know.
Right. So first off, let me just briefly go over why this is such a weaselly little article.
It's not a weaselly little article. It's stating the truth. I mean,
it's not stating the truth. We'll get to that right now.
With major game releases that are released on PC and console, the console versions outsell the PC. The PC version something like 8-1 or 9-1 or 10-1 sometimes.
Correct. So here's how you can tell that this guy, whoever wrote this article, and it's not David Cole that wrote the article. They're writing the article about David Cole, but how you can tell that there's weaselly stuff going on in here. So he uses phrases like outperforming the console sector. He doesn't say that it's outselling the console sector. He says it's outperforming the console sector, which could just be a percentage increase. It's not necessarily that PC games sold more. It's that it's outperforming.
It's making more money.
It's not making more money. I have an article here from Gartner, right? This article from Gartner was written in October of 2013. And in 2012, the total global video game market was $78.8 billion. Of that $78.8 billion, consoles made up $37.4 billion. PC games made up $14.4 billion. So it's around 2.5-1 consoles over PC. And that held in 2013 though. And that's holding in 2014.
Well, here's the thing, the PC
market is increasing faster than the console market.
Well,
if you count from 2012 to 2014, the PC market has grown about 1.3%. The console market has grown 1.2%. Or sorry, 1.1%.
Well, you know where PCs have made most of their money, at least in catching up, is the fact that what do PC do more than consoles do? Free-to-play. Free-to-play.
And microtransactions.
Microtransactions sell a bunch. That's why Nintendo's so envious of the iOS devices, because people on the iOS devices spend like they're going out of style on it, you know.
So, and that's part of it too, is that one of the things that that David Cole is saying is that PC games are sell more on a global basis. So he's counting all of those Chinese MMOs, he's counting all of those Korean MMOs.
Well, definitely, but you can't not include them.
Well, you can't not include them, but it's not the same as when you say, you know, PC gaming. Most people wouldn't consider games not in their native language to be relevant, and I don't consider them to be relevant.
The
other part of this is you notice that in the entire article he does not discuss any numbers whatsoever, which is a huge red flag. He doesn't even discuss.
Well, they do have the numbers. You just have to pay to get them.
Maybe.
But the thing is, in
the article they could have said something like, you know, PC gaming has grown by X percent. They didn't. It's a completely fact-free article.
Well, I will say this. Here's the thing.
And then my favorite part. Let me get my favorite part. So at the end, he says that in 2013, not a single title released in 2013 made the top 20 most played games. You can't have PC suddenly outstripping consoles if nobody's buying the games.
Well,
if they're playing
that's not what he said,
5 years ago
was that the top-selling PC games were older games, and there's a reason for that. Steam just makes them so damn attractive, you know?
Right.
I mean,
well, they make them so damn attractive by making them dirt cheap.
Well, yeah. I mean, but they're not dirt cheap. Well, sometimes they are. I mean, the Humble Bundle makes them extremely cheap.
Yeah, exactly.
But the thing is that basically, the
article was just one lie after another.
Starting to play more PC games than console games at the moment. Now, that I usually go into those go in ebbs and flows, right? You know.
Uh-huh.
But the thing is that I do get the feeling that there's more of a mind share going on with PC games, because one thing about the PC games right now, it's getting more innovative games out there. you know, games that that are completely fresh and new, which is not what you're getting on consoles.
And fresh and new is fine, but that doesn't get into the sales. And like I say, anybody who reads this article, take about 5 seconds on Google, turn up the Gartner article, and you'll see the console expanding from 47 to 48 to 49%, and the PC market expanding from 17 to 18 to 19.
Jordan, why don't you go and find out how much League of Legends and Dota are making? They're making more than any console game, I'll tell you that. Because people are paying for that DLC, you know, and they're paying a lot of money for it. So, you know, we're going to move on to listener feedback from Paul Pretke. Hey, guys, a short comment on Naughty Dog. While it is true that people often leave studios after the game is completed, this is not the case with Naughty Dog. The game is far from done, and with one of the main villains also leaving and being recast. What? One of the main villains?
One of the actors left the game and they had to recast him. Yeah.
Oh, okay. The actual character left the game.
No, this is not Wreck-It Ralph.
That'd be hilarious, actually, if you had a game in which the villain said, "You know what? I'm not playing in this game. I'm going. You can get yourself another guy." The game seems to be in trouble and will probably come out later than previously expected. Still, I trust Naughty Dog and believe that they will be able to put out a quality product. The problem with that statement is that Uncharted 3 wasn't that great. You know?
Uncharted 3 had major problems. It was not as good as Uncharted 2.
What's
correct.
That noise?
I don't know.
I hear something from your end. Anyway, on to the gaming nostalgia theme. There are so many things I used to do as a younger gamer, playing PC games mostly. Mostly, I no longer buy gaming magazines. I used to be a longtime subscriber to one such magazine in Poland, but I lost interest in PC gaming. And when I came back to gaming with the PS3, I realized I could get all the info online and or listening to podcasts. I don't mind reading as a whole, but as far as gaming goes, I'd rather read books such as The Masters of Doom, which I just finished, and then read gaming magazines. Also, I very rarely play couch multiplayer games. To play Mule, you could only play with people by your side. You couldn't play that even if online existed. There's no way I would have played Mule online. You had to do it with friends next to you.
Which is so weird because Mario Party always has a really high resale value.
Oh.
There's Paul. Hi, Paul.
Hello. Oh, there you are. Mostly because these are modes that are rare in games nowadays, but also because when we meet up with friends, we usually play board games that can accommodate more people, which our wives can also enjoy too. However, move-based games such as Sports Champions or Just Dance get played occasionally. I really enjoyed the episode with the old-school gaming talk and find it much more interesting than reading pre-prepared gaming history segments. This episode had much more discussion and excitement than previously, but maybe that's just me. Also, there's something different about Paul's voice. He sounded clearer and less grainy. I hope that's permanent.
I'm almost insulted.
He was on his phone. That was the big difference, right?
Well, yes.
Well,
you must have a very good phone, Paul.
They're not criticizing your voice. They're criticizing the vector in which you used it.
Well, now I just feel like a shrieking howler monkey.
What?
Paul, by the way, this is apropos of nothing, but my wife told me to tell you that there is a Doctor Who parody porn video.
You know what? I actually have one.
You have a porn video?
It's like Attack of the Daleks or something. You know how when you go to like New York Comic-Con or a Big Apple Comic-Con or whatever, that they have like weird DVDs of stuff that's just like bootlegged and you know, like $5 DVDs. I like one of them was just called Revenge of the Daleks. I had no idea, but I was really, really like into Doctor Who at the time. And it really is like cheap copies of the Daleks chasing half-naked women around the screen for apparently 45 minutes.
They, you know, Riff Trax has two Doctor Who movies that they riffed.
So it must be the Peter Cushing ones from the late 60s and early 70s.
I'd have to look it up. I think one is called Something of the Daleks. I don't know what the other one is called. Anyway, since Paul is here, you can do Alpha Shard's letter.
From Alpha Shard. Hi, guys. Great show. I love the top 10 fads article of stuff no longer in use. Yeah, that was fun. We should do that again. At GameStop, that just seems sad. I guess they're going for a joke, but it would have been nice to show actual female execs that Jordan had mentioned. At Naughty Dog losing people, that does concern me. If people are leaving the franchise, which has done pretty well so far, I wonder if the quality of Uncharted will suffer because of this. I have enjoyed all three games so far. If Uncharted 4 is going to be a PS4 exclusive, I may have to break down and get it. I have enjoyed this series so much. Any one of the games would have made a better indie. This time, I really do mean Indiana Jones movie. Okay. At the top 10 fads. 1. I don't remember the Blockbuster exclusives, and the store exclusives seem to be more recent, like when you pre-order a game from Target versus Best Buy and get a different exclusive depending on where you bought it. Oh, yeah. I remember that. 2. I was an abuser and sucker for that hint line before game guides and the internet. I think Sierra and Nintendo, though I love them, were perhaps making some of their puzzles so obtuse you were forced to call their hint line to buy or buy their magazine.
You think?
I remember having gotten a lot of game guides, both from Sierra and Nintendo. This one fad, I am glad, is gone thanks to the internet. Demo discs. I remember that well. It's how I got Doom and Hexen. Oh yeah, I played both of those. It was a nice way to try out games before buying, at least. 4. I didn't mind physical DRM. I thought it was kind of fun. There was a tabloid space magazine.
Stop for a second. What is that noise? I hear clacking. It's like, do you hear that, Jordan?
I heard something. I thought it was just Paul typing on the keyboard or something.
I'm not typing. I'm reading.
Okay. Maybe it's his microphone grazing or something. I don't know.
I think it's all in your head, Jonah.
It's not in my head because it's for being recorded.
I heard a little tap, tap, tap or something.
Well, then I think it's all in your head, Jonah.
No, it's on my podcast.
Well, if our fans hear it, write in and tell Jonah that he's crazy.
I'm going to try it. I have to remove it. That's
send Jonah.
I don't want my fans to hear it. I want to remove that sound.
You want a clean podcast.
Yeah. Anyways,
send
moving
Jonah
on.
Your hate. There was a tabloid space magazine with Space Quest V, and it had a star chart for planets for you to go to. So long as you had those coordinates from the chart, you could get to any planet you needed to go to. I think when the DRM was more seamless and less heavy-handed, like the enter a code from a page, paragraph, line, and word 3, it was more fun and immersive. It's all like any feature, depends on how you handle it. The SQV Star. Yeah, whatever. I'm sorry, am I supposed to memorize every acronym that's ever happened anywhere?
No, but it was repeated before for you at Space Quest V.
I'm sorry, you're making the assumption that I remember what happened 30 seconds ago. I've been traumatized. The Star Quest V star chart felt like it fit with the tongue-in-cheek nature of the Space Quest series. You could imagine yourself as Roger using the tabloid magazine to chart his way through space.
Now, you were a big fan of the Sierra Online adventure games, though, Paul.
I was?
That's what you said, if I remember correctly.
I mean, I played a couple of them. I think they were mostly in demo discs, though. I'm not sure that I've ever actually completed any of them. I remember this one time I had to sneak out of a nightclub dressed as a can-canning showgirl, and it was the hardest thing in the world to find a pair of fake boobs.
I was afraid that you were talking about in real life there. For a moment,
no,
I thought
we're not talking about your life.
I thought you were talking about something you had to do in real life, and you know, and try. You said you had to do that and sneak home to get to play your games or something.
No.
Anyways.
5. The slips thing I understand, though. Now these days, I'm buying my games digitally and less from stores. 6. I can't say that I played any games from cereal boxes. Mostly felt Like, they wouldn't be good games, so why bother? Especially when I could be playing games I knew were good. Oh, they also gave away CD-ROM games in Happy Meals for a while, back around the time that Disney's Treasure Planet came out.
I remember that.
I don't. Yeah. I do there remember.
There are also a selection of handheld games made by Sega that McDonald's gave away.
But I do remember McDonald's selling, of course, the Xbox 360 games like Sneak Thief. And
you remember McDonald's selling Sneak Thief?
Sneak Thief. Oh, I know. Sneak
King. It was Burger King.
Oh, it was Burger King. That's right. It was Burger King, Sneak King, and those two other games. I still haven't played Sneak King. I need to get those achievements at some point.
I remember back when Disney apparently had a series of three exclusive CDs on sale at McDonald's.
I remember those.
Yeah, one was like love songs, one was hero songs, and one was villain songs.
Yeah,
that was cool. Marketing. Six, I can't say that I play. Sorry, I did that one. Seven, I don't remember any pin pads for saving progress in arcade games. We didn't talk about that. I do miss having those huge gaming magazines that would just seem full of gaming goodies. The ads were nice since they were tailored for gaming desires as opposed to things that wouldn't have appeal to us gamers. Nine, I remember the cleaning kits, and I'm like Jordan. I kept my games in their sleeves when not in use. Also, pins facing down so as not to collect any dust in the metal pins. The rest of my room was a mess, but my games were clean, damn it. I do admit to blowing on them a few times, but not a lot. There was an article online showing the effects of a Don't Laugh daily blowing on the cartridge versus one that was used during a cleaning kit. Well, yes, but you should provide the link so we can cross-reference. Ken, I think a sweet note is the one with Robin Williams and his daughter and him explaining how he named her Zelda. I remember Sony trying very hard to make a Crash Bandicoot a beloved mascot and failing miserably.
Talking about game commercials.
Yeah. I also remember the Game Genie and its game-breaking ways of cheating. I'm glad Jordan mentioned that. Yeah. Oh, at the question of the week, I had to think about this, but I suppose going to a game rental store like Blockbuster or even going to a game store, period. I do everything digitally now, no more worrying about scratching discs or losing a cartridge or any of those worries with physical media.
Of course, now you just go to Redbox, you know.
Well, plus, doesn't he live in Poland? Oh, no, that's the other one.
No, that's Paul Pretke.
That's Pretke.
Yeah, yeah. But, you know, you do have Redbox now.
That's true. Redbox is big.
Yeah, you know, the funny thing is the red box near me only has like a handful of games. One of them is Grand Theft Auto 5 for the 360 and the rest are Wii games. Not Wii U games, but Wii games.
They do seem to be very, very child-centric and...
It's not that it's child-centric, it's just no selections.
Well, and not a very good selection, but, you know, games isn't their primary mover. You really have to, if you're going to use Redbox, you have to go online and search for your stuff online and then have it tell you which box to go to get what you want.
Yeah. So at least we had a little bit of Paul in this episode.
Yay, Paul!
Yay, Paul! Oh, wait, I'm sorry. I wasn't listening. I just heard my name.
Yeah, look for our show notes at GamingPodcast.net along with industry news and our gaming history articles. We enjoy feedback, so leave us comments at our blog at GamingPodcast.net. See, I even say it every time, GamingPodcast.net. Also, hit us up at Facebook.com/GamingPodcast or the forums at GamingPodcast.net/forum or send your comments to fans@GamingPodcast.net. You can also check out our gaming news on GameStooge.com. Also, subscribe to us on iTunes and leave us some iTunes comments. And, of course, there's still Team USA's Pinsanity, which is still on Facebook.
It is still on Facebook, iOS, and Android.
Yeah. I didn't know about
it. But, Paul, do you actually care? Do you still work for them?
I have moved on to other things.
There you go.
By the way, that reminds me. You know, I've been playing Lords of Waterdeep on my iPad today. I just bought it today. I forgot about that. And I got the expansion, too.
Well, I got to go get the PlayStation 4 new firmware update and see what it does.
Yeah. So that was the three of us, and hopefully the three of us will be here next week.
Yeah, sorry I missed you guys yesterday. I had a car problem. It's issues.
Yeah.
But I have a new car now, so yay.
Wait, what's the make and model?
It is a 2013 Kia Sorento.
Ooh, nice. So we'll see you next week.
See you next week.
Bye, Bonds.